Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the filibuster underway in the U.S. Senate by Democratic senators led by senators from Connecticut who represent a community where young school children were massacred in Newtown, Connecticut in December of 2012. Joshua Horwitz, the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, joins us to discuss the determination of Senator Chris Murphy and others to keep talking until the Senate does something about America's constantly recurring massacre problem. This follows the latest bloodbath in Orlando, where 49 people were gunned down by a killer who had been investigated and interviewed by the FBI twice because of terrorist threats he had made. Yet he was hired as an armed security guard and was able to buy an assault rifle and a pistol shortly before turning the guns on innocent revelers at a nightclub. Then we'll look into the hacking of the Democratic National Committee's servers, allegedly by Russian intelligence services looking for opposition research the Democrats have on Donald Trump. Rosh Shulman, senior policy counsel at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, joins us to discuss the Russian intrusion, which was only detected in April after the Russian hackers had been lurking inside the DNC's network for almost a year. We'll also assess why Russian and Chinese hackers were able to break into the State Department and the Office of Personnel Management, leaving the impression that much of the government is simply not up to the task of protecting its own data. Then finally, we will speak with Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect, who was formerly the chief investigator of the Senate Banking Committee, about his article at the Huffington Post, Trump and Mateen, Brothers in Hate. We will discuss the other sick symbiosis between Trump and the Islamic State, given that Trump has been able to shamelessly exploit the Orlando tragedy. And if ISIS terrorists again strike the United States, the resulting hysteria is likely to boost Trump's chance of becoming the next president of the United States. And joining us now is Joshua Horwitz, who is the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He is currently a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the co-author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. He has spent nearly two decades working on gun violence prevention issues. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joshua Horwitz.
Thank you very much, Ian, for having me tonight.
And I must say that even though all of us are sort of, you know, guardedly, perhaps a little cynical about the ability of the House and Senate to do something about gun sanity in this country, following what happened after Newtown, the massacre of kindergarten children, enormous outpouring of national and international outrage. The President of the United States was clearly deeply affected by it. There was a majority of Americans who wanted something done, and yet the minority in the House of under the influence of the NRA were able to block anything being done. Now we have a filibuster on the Senate floor led by Senator Chris Murphy of Democrat of Connecticut on a bill put forth by Dianne Feinstein. What do you think the chances are this time?
Well, you know, they're going to go as long as they can on this thing. I think that they've put enormous, and I think the last couple of days have put enormous pressure on the Republicans to come up with some type of deal on this. The NRA, of course, is opposed. What they're filibustering about is is what's called terror gap, which allows people who are on the no-fly list or the terrorist watch list to continue to buy firearms. And so the NRA today actually came out with some statements saying that they do support it, although, of course, they were talking about support for a watered-down bill. But it's clear that they need to come to the table on these things. And I think there's actually some backroom deals, backroom discussions right now about how to resolve this. And I think it just shows how strong this movement, how strong this issue has become in the last 3 years. You know, we were very disappointed with the loss of background checks. We didn't get that through after Sandy Hook. But it was the birth of a movement, and that movement is showing its full muscle today. What I'm just fascinated about is how, you know, a couple of years ago, people used to always say to me, but you even have Democrats who don't support you. Well, now our Democratic senators, our Democratic nominee, are all there. You can argue that they're in front of the movement. They are so strong and powerful on this issue, and that's how you see change occurring. So are we going to get all we want tonight? Probably not. Are we making a really good start to show the strength that we need to get things done? Yes. This is the beginning of a big change.
So what is Donald Trump, what sort of a game is he playing with the NRA? You're saying that they're sort of ostensibly agreeing with the... I mean, first of all, you have to admit, Joshua Horwitz, that I think the rest of the world must be scratching its head in dismay. The idea that people on the terrorist watch list are able to buy military-style weapons, that in itself is just unbelievable. So defending it is even more surreal.
Yeah, it's really complete insanity to do that. I mean, these are people who are under investigation, who are, you know, they're thought to be have terrorist connections. They're thought that they may actually commit violence sometime soon, maybe not immediately. But the idea that we're then going to arm them with military-style assault weapons is it's insane. And of course, the rest of the world just does think so. And I think, look, the American people do too. There's just no excuse for this. Other than that the gun lobby has been very reluctant to give it ground anywhere. But I think you asked about Trump, what was fascinating about Trump, Trump says today, and I'm sure he caught the NRA off guard, I'm going to talk to the NRA about this, because he's actually in the past had some supported this terror gap legislation. So, you know, I think that he sees this as something he actually needs to do. It would be unsustainable on the campaign trail if you can't support closing the terror gap after what's happened. So he's in a box, too, and he probably, you know, even though he got the NRA endorsement, he probably doesn't mind throwing them under the bus right now. So we'll just see what happens. But it's just such a strong indicator of how the politics of this has rapidly changed in the last couple of years.
But when the NRA says that they're sort of agreeing with Trump and are willing to negotiate the closing the loophole that allows people on the terrorist watch list to buy firearms, but they're really, that's a bit of a sleight of hand, isn't it? Aren't they basically talking about supporting the Senator Cornyn's bill, the Republican senator from Texas, his bill, which is just a hollow shell of a bill that essentially does nothing? It's just cosmetic.
Right. So the Cornyn bill is just an unworkable situation. It would only give the FBI 3 days. They'd have to go to court and prove someone was about to commit a terror crime. So that's just not workable. And it's a ridiculous sort of idea. What you need is, while people are under investigation and while they've been, you know, while they're, you know, while the FBI is conducting their due diligence, to make sure that they don't have firearms before a disaster happens. And the Justice Department should be given the discretion to stop that sale if they feel that they need to. These are all temporary stops until the investigations are closed. But the idea that we're giving the benefit of the doubt to suspected terrorists doesn't make any sense. The American people don't think it makes any sense. And that's why Senator Feinstein's bill and some of the other proposals make a lot more sense. So, you know, Cornyn is now, and I think there's, you know, some negotiations going on. Cornyn says it's complex. It's really not that complex. These are people under investigation for their terrorist connections. While the pendency of the investigation, let's not err on the side of massive death. And I think that's what's going on. And I think, you know, the NRA has their position, but all the senators and all the reps have to stand in front of their constituents and say, oh yeah, I wasn't in support of this terror gap legislation. That's a hard lift after Orlando, and I think that's why you're going to see some movement on this, if not tonight, in the next couple of weeks.
And again, I'm speaking with Joshua Horwitz, who's the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He's currently a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the co-author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. He has spent nearly two decades working on gun violence prevention issues. So how did this happen in the first place, though, that the NRA was able to get this legislation passed, preventing people on the terrorist watch list allowing people on the terrorist watch list to purchase firearms? How did they even get to that point?
It's not that they passed a piece of legislation. It's just that in the gun laws, most of them, which date back to 1968, in the categories of prohibitions, which we have people who have a felony conviction, people who have been committed to a mental institution, we didn't put on the terrorist watch list. People on the terrorist watch list, I think probably because those the, you know, that was in 1968, that wasn't an issue, right? So these lists have, you know, the, after 9/11, we've had a more robust vetting process for people, and this has come up since then, and we have not been able to, it's not the NRA passed something that allowed people on the terrorist watch list to get guns, but there has always been that gap, and we're trying to close it. That's why it's called the terror gap, because it wasn't included in the original categories, which we've largely had since 1968. There's been a couple of changes. One of them was to add people under domestic violence protective orders, and domestic violence misdemeanors can't get firearms. But those are some of the very few changes we've made in that, in those categories. And, you know, there's been a lot of change and better research and changed conditions since 1968. And we, you know, as we've unfortunately had to fight the war on terror, we really need to upgrade all of our systems, and this is one that's just lagged woefully behind. Why the NRA has decided to, you know, wants to pick, make this as their stand, only, I think, undermines how craven they are for just, let's make sure that anybody can have a gun of any type at any time. And I think that's, you're seeing that idea coming to an end.
But it's often missed, I think, in discussions about the NRA, that they are essentially a lobbying group for the guns and ammunition manufacturers. Isn't that their primary purpose?
Right, and I think that's what's going on here. So I think that the idea that if you can limit, you know, sales here, you know, then that may actually extend to, you know, to other categories of people who are at risk, which it should. I mean, we should be looking at, but we know a lot more about risk. And I think their prime objective is to make sure there's never any regulation, so that there's never an impeding nothing that would impede a gun sale. And so that's why I think there's, you know, I think there's a sort of, you know, they have this slippery slope argument they make, which is sort of ridiculous because, you know, that's their main operandi. Get a little toehold, for instance, in concealed carry. Next thing you know, you have guns on campus, right? So I think that's their argument against this, but it's endangering the American public. And just to be clear about what we're talking about, there have been a couple of thousand people on the terrorist watch list and the no-fly list who have bought firearms, and the Justice Department has not been able to stop it. So this is not hypothetical. It's real. It's a couple of thousand people, and that's going to continue unless we do something. And remember, the shooter in Orlando was on the terrorist watch list for a period. So, you know, this is something that is common sense. It's, you know, we live in an age where terror is possible, so we have to be careful. But the idea that we're selling, you know, the weapon, like an AR-15 style weapon, which is made for battlefield, to people on the terrorist watch list or the no-fly list is really just insane.
But if you just take the example you just gave us of the Orlando shooter, the fact that he was briefly on the terrorist watch list, he was interviewed twice by the FBI because he'd made statements in support of terrorists and particularly ISIS-type terrorists. The idea that he was on it and then he got off it and committed this atrocity would indicate so logically that those people that are still on the list have even a higher threshold of threat than this guy posed.
Well, that's a good point, right? I mean, people come in and off that list because they're under investigation, they're under a watch list, and then they may not be. But yes, there are people on that list who probably are, to the FBI, much bigger threats than they thought the shooter was at the time. I also want to, I mean, we've talked a lot about this terrorist watch list, but I also want to make a point about the shooter in general. Right after this happened, the FBI came out there and said, if you see something, say something. But the reality is, even if you say something, we don't really have the tools to stop gun sales in America. The presumption is they're allowed unless you have a good reason, you know, one of these reasons laid out in the 1968 Gun Control Act, mostly, you know, people who are felons and things like that. So we need to upgrade that whole criteria, and I'll tell you why. If you look at the shooter's history, we know that he was abusing his wife, that his coworkers were afraid of him. We know because of research that we've done recently, you know, that's been come out recently, that, you know, it may not be, you know, people, there's a lot of correlation between people with anger disorders and gun carrying. We need to upgrade our whole system of approach. One of the things, for instance, that California just did is something called a gun violence restraining order. And in California, starting on January 1st of this year, a family member or friend can get a civil restraining order a family member or law enforcement can get a civil restraining order to temporarily remove a firearm when they can go to a judge and say, my family member is in crisis. We need to make sure they don't have access to firearms. Now, of course, there's a big suicide issue there as well, but we need a much better system and a more modern system of classifications for purchasing and possessing firearms, because we know a lot now, a lot more, and we know that past violence is a really good predictor of future violence. Yet, in most states, people with violent misdemeanor offenses, multiple violent misdemeanor offenses, can still buy firearms. So we just need to do a much better job, and there's some really interesting approaches. And whether we find out whether the shooter was, you know, connected to ISIS or not, he had a lot of non-terrorist risk factors. He was a violent person. He's obviously an angry person. And he was someone, I think, objectively, if you could have looked at the matter beforehand, was at a really increased risk of violence. I wrote about this for U.S. News yesterday. And we just need better tools. And some states are starting to develop those tools. But when the FBI says, if you see something, say something so we can keep you safe, they don't even have the tools to remove firearms from people who may be at risk. We need better tools.
Well, on top of that, the shooter was a security guard. He was an armed security guard. And I believe that he had, when he bought these weapons, he was able to show the gun dealer that he was also a security guard, which gave him more credibility. I believe he even had some kind of license that they issue. What kind of vetting do security companies operate on?
Well, I really can't speak to the security company. I can tell you that it was reported that he had a Florida concealed carry license. And in Florida, there's a very low threshold for carrying a weapon. And it's what's called a shall issue state. So again, there's some narrow categories of who can't have a firearm, but if you don't have one of those disqualifiers, law enforcement shall give you a firearm. It just shows how poorly and how these systems are designed and how they just really scratch the surface. This person was objectively at a risk, probably was at a risk for future violence. The idea that he could buy an AR-15, that he had a license from the state of Florida, just shows how poorly our gun laws are designed and how we need to do a much better job. And the good news is there's a lot of new research that points us in the direction of how to, and many times just temporarily, make sure people who are at increased risk of violence don't have firearms. We need to, to do that, you need to pass laws. And some of those can be done in the states, but this terror gap thing, as we've mentioned, has to be done in the Senate. And that's taken a lot of work, but we're starting to see the fruits of that labor tonight.
Well, just in closing, the fact that the senators, particularly Chris Murphy of Connecticut and Dianne Feinstein and others, and of course she brought about the assault weapons ban that lasted for 10 years, and we wouldn't have had any of these mass shootings had that ban not sunsetted. But these senators, you think that there's a good chance that they can shame the Republicans, the majority, into doing something?
The Republicans are running for cover. Pat Toomey, Republican senator of Pennsylvania, has already joined the filibuster. It's very unusual for people on the opposite party to join a filibuster. He's vulnerable. He knows he needs this. You know, gun violence prevention is a winning issue now in most states. And so I think there's going to be enormous pressure to put this behind most of these senators before the elections. I don't think people will be able to, win statewide elections in places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and Minnesota and all those places where you know, in New Hampshire, Kelly Ayotte is one of the people I'm thinking about. I don't think they'll be able to win if they don't do something about Terror Gap, if they don't support closing the Terror Gap. So the question is, there's going to be a watered-down version, and there's going to be a good version. Where do we end up, I think, is really the question.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Joshua Horwitz.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Joshua Horwitz, who's the executive director of the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence. He is currently a visiting scholar at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the co-author of Guns, Democracy, and the Insurrectionist Idea. He has spent nearly two decades working on gun violence prevention issues. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the Russian hack of the DNC, looking for dirt on Trump. It's like the sun. You see the best of me when I have got my gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. I'm gonna get me a gun. And those people who put me down. And all your energy. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Rosh Shulman, who's a senior policy counsel at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, where he focuses on cybersecurity, encryption, surveillance, and internet governance. Previously, he worked for Google, also at the Computer and Communications Industry Association, the Center for Democracy and Technology, and on Capitol Hill for Senators Wyden and Feingold. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rosh Shulman.
Thanks very much, Ian. It's good to be here.
And the hack that has been attributed to Russian intelligence of the DNC's service apparently was only detected in April, but apparently the hackers were lurking inside the network for almost a year. Is that your understanding?
Right, that's what we're hearing from the group that the DNC brought in from outside to evaluate the hack, a group called CrowdStrike. And they're estimating, based on what they're seeing inside the network, that yeah, it's been about a year since one of the two groups. It actually looks like there were two groups that hacked the DNC sort of separately, but both from Russia. One of those groups has been in for a year, yeah.
And the second group, called Fancy Bear, that apparently is understood to be the GRU, Russian military intelligence.
Right. So nobody's really sure, but it looks like the other group is definitely the FSB. We know that. But yes, the second group, we're not really sure who they're affiliated with in Russia, but the working hypothesis is that it's the GRU. That's correct.
And in the second case, the GRU apparently were looking for opposition research that the Democrats probably have on Donald Trump. Is that right. Correct?
That's right. And sort of the theory is that Donald Trump has not been a politician for very long. And so foreign intelligence services may not have a dossier on him just yet. And so one great way to get a dossier is to get other people to compile it and then steal it from them. And so that seems like what the GRU has done in this case, at least that's the theory.
So there's nothing in that hack then that suggests there have been rumors. You know, there, of course, is not a rumor that there's a sort of bromance between Putin and Trump. But there are also rumors that Russian oligarch money, you know, Russia is essentially a mafia state, is being laundered through the Russian diaspora in Israel, and some of it's ending up in investing in Trump. Is there anything to that, and would they have been acting preemptively if that were true?
Well, I certainly don't know about that. You know, I think what's what's more, the simpler explanation is that anyone who's going to be president of the United States, foreign nations want to know about. And since Trump is now the presumptive nominee of the Republican Party, you know, he has a chance of becoming next president. And so, you know, I'm sure that the Russian government and probably many other governments around the world are scrambling to put together what they might know about him. And like I said, this is one way to go about doing it.
So what does it say then about our government's ability in general? And not that the DNC is a part of the government, but when you think about, you know, this all of this sort of scandal, or if indeed it is a scandal, we'll find out eventually, I guess, about Hillary Clinton's use of private email service. The point about that, which seems to be missed in all of the hysteria over it, is that as far as we know, Hillary Clinton's servers weren't hacked, but the State Department's were. And we certainly know that the Office of Personnel Management was hacked, and all of the dossiers on, particularly on intelligence and defense people inside the U.S. government, apparently have ended up in China. So I guess the question that arises here is, it looks as if that much of the government is simply not up to the task of protecting its own data.
Well, and that's exactly, you know, that's right. It seems so. As you said, the DNC is not a part of the government and don't have does not have access to even the sort of advanced cybersecurity that the government can turn to in the form of the NSA, the Information Assurance Division, and they obviously have gotten hacked. They're sort of in no better a position than any small sort of corporation might be. But as you say, you know, we can see that even the federal government itself, with all the resources that it does have, still is having a hard time securing the data that it is holding, and even having access to the entirety of the NSA is not a foolproof recipe for avoiding a breach of some kind.
And again, I'm speaking with Ross Shulman, who's Senior Policy Counsel at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, where he focuses on cybersecurity, encryption, surveillance, the internet, and internet governance. And previously he worked for Google, also at the Computer and Communications Industry Association, the Center for Democracy and Technology, and on Capitol Hill for Senators Wyden and Feingold. So one assumes that the NSA has pretty good firewalls, and so does the CIA, presumably, and the FBI. Why is it that can't be shared throughout the rest of the government? Because it seems like, for example, with the Office of Personnel Management, the problem was with the contractors that they hired. They were the ones that were not up to the task. And I don't know whether it's a fair comparison, but we all remember when Barack Obama launched his signature achievement, which is so-called Obamacare, on the internet for the public to have access to it, the whole thing crashed and burned. And there was a lot of recriminations about the quality of the contractors that were hired. In the case of OPM, there's no question that these contractors screwed up. But what's even more extraordinary is that the contractors that were hired to replace the OPM disgrace contractors just recently sort of folded up and disappeared.
Right, and so this is just a great example of the fact that good cybersecurity help is hard to find, right? It's today, you know, mostly concentrated in sort of California, right? The big companies out there can afford to hire lots and lots of security engineers who are sort of the best trained in the business, and they all go out there, and sort of the rest of us are left trying to deal with what we have left. You know, I think it's interesting to note in this case, at least, that as far as we know, at least, and CrowdStrike, again, the group that the DNC, the security cybersecurity group that the DNC brought in to examine the breach that they had, has said that they don't know yet how the attackers got into this system. But the sort of operating theory that they have right now is that it was a spear phishing attack. And this is a really specific kind of attack that is targeted against organizations where folks know one another, and where you can, say, get an email from someone from an email address that looks like it's from your boss saying, hey, you know, I need you to go to this website and click OK or something to that effect. Usually it's dressed up a little bit more than that. But what you're really doing is installing some sort of malware on your computer. So this sort of really targeted attack where you know the name of the person you're attacking, and you know the sort of the name of their boss, and you know maybe what sort of language might get them to click on a given link, for example, is hard to defend against in software, right? It really preys upon our instincts as human beings to, you know, you get an email from your boss and it says urgent in the headline and you know, and it says, you know, just click on this link and do this thing real quick. I need you to do this right away. You know, the customer XYZ is waiting on it. That sort of attack is really tailored to our weaknesses as human beings and is very hard to defend against in software. And that's one of the major problems that we're seeing in cybersecurity today.
But is there an asymmetry then between Russia's ability and China's ability to penetrate all of these government servers and now the DNC on top of that? Do they simply have more people? China, of course, have a massive population. And the New York Times revealed a while back that there's a unit of the People's Liberation Army that essentially dedicated to hacking. But so is that part of it? That, I mean, or do other countries have inherently more skills than we do? Or do we simply don't know about what kind of skills we have and how they're arrayed and deployed?
Well, yeah, I think so. There is an asymmetry, but I think it's not an asymmetry of skills. There's actually, I think, two asymmetries. There's an asymmetry, first of all, of norms, and that is that our norm here in the United States is, generally speaking, that our government intelligence services are more restrained about attacking non-government actors on the other side. That's not to say that they don't do it, but the norm is that they're more restrained than, say, the Russian government or the Chinese government is. There's also, I think, less of a existence of a unaffiliated but probably still government-guided squad of sort of teenagers in basements who execute all sorts of lower-level attacks. We see this a lot, you know, Chinese and Russian, for example. Not strictly affiliated with the government, but there's this, you know, everyone's sort of, there's a nod and a wink that they are following some sort of orders, right? And then I think the other asymmetry is a sort of an information asymmetry on the part of the populace, which is to say that when the NSA or something to that effect hacks, you know, a foreign target, it doesn't generally end up in the news. So we might not know about it necessarily, but that's not to say that it's not happening.
Well, the Chinese government have what they call the 50-cent cadre, which is thousands and thousands of people. They get 50 cents every time they post something positive about the government on the internet or troll some critic or potential critic. And I believe the Russians have also government-paid trolls as well. So to that extent, I guess, there's an asymmetry that I don't see the U.S. government engaging in that level. And not that that's particularly sophisticated compared to what we're talking about, but
no, it can be completely unsophisticated. I mean, I think that those same trolls are engaged in massive sort of misinformation and propaganda campaigns as well, which we wouldn't necessarily consider a cybersecurity risk, but at the same time are absolutely that sort of, you know, creating an atmosphere online, say on Twitter, for example, that definitely affects the geopolitical situation without actually being a cybersecurity incident.
So is there any, I mean, I guess what you're telling us, Ross Shulman, is only the big internet companies in Silicon Valley and presumably the big banks and the NSA and the FBI and the CIA, as much as we know, basically, they're the only ones that have good security, and presumably, in order to have good security in this internet age, you've got to have extremely proactive people that are very skilled, that are constantly, because isn't that the thing? You've got to detect the intrusion the instant it happens.
Yeah, so I think there's a bunch of things that that your sort of mom and pop small business can do to protect themselves, particularly because it's relatively unlikely that someone like that is going to be the target of what we call an advanced persistent threat or an APT. That's really, you know, the Russian government or the Chinese government, these sorts of like governmental forces that can bring that kind of power to bear. That's the sort of reserved for a special kind of target, right? It's not going to be aimed at every mom and pop. So if all you are is that sort of lower level mom and pop, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, keep my corner store running. There's definitely some basic things that you can do. You know, don't reuse passwords across websites. Turn on two-factor authentication where it's available to you. Stuff like that where you can do, you know, 95% of it without too much difficulty, and it's going to protect you a whole lot.
Well, in the meantime, though, you know, the government, what's happening? I mean, if OPM's was hacked because of a bad contractor allowed it to happen, and then the replacement contractor just quit, I don't know who the third one in line is. You're telling us that because the cream of the crop has been already taken by Silicon Valley or by the NSA, the rest of the government's kind of got, you know, sloppy seconds.
You know, that's what one thing that we're worried about. But you know, it's heartening to see that the Obama administration is trying to do something in their last year here. You know, they launched just a couple of months ago the Cybersecurity National Action Plan, which aims to take some lessons that we've learned from the U.S. Digital Service, where engineers are coming from the big Silicon Valley companies and doing basically a tour of duty, if you will, in Washington, D.C. And this grew out of a group of folks that came from California to sort of do some patching on healthcare.gov back when that sort of crashed and burned a little bit. So they're trying to take that lessons learned from that and apply it to cybersecurity so we can rotate these people through and at least, you know, learn a little bit, help them set up some best practices in the U.S. government, and so on and so forth. There's also other things in the National Action Plan that are aiming to help that, including, you know, a government-wide chief information security officer who's going to help the individual departments beef up their game and stuff like that. So, you know, in their defense, the government knows that they're in a bad way, but fixing it's going to take a little while probably.
So just in the last minute, though, in terms of the crash and burn of Obama's Obamacare website, was that a problem of just, I think it was a Canadian company, but going to the lowest bidder? I mean, I guess, you know, isn't that one of the things that governments are required to do?
Yeah.
They don't like giving out, they're not allowed to give out sole source contracts. They've got to have competitive bidding and and sometimes go to the lowest bidder.
Yeah, well, so I mean, I think exploring what went wrong with the federal procurement process with healthcare.gov is probably going to take more than the minute we have left.
Right,
but
right.
Yes, I mean, generally speaking, yeah, I mean, it was given to a company that did not have the same ability to really innovate in the way that the Silicon Valley companies do when they're building their services. And so a lot of the lessons that could have been brought to bear were not at the beginning and unfortunately had to be sort of patched on at the end there.
Well, Ross Shulman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Ross Shulman, who's a senior policy counsel at the New America Foundation's Open Technology Institute, where he focuses on cybersecurity, encryption, surveillance, and internet governance. Previously, he worked for Google, also at the Computer and Communications Industry Association, the Center for Democracy and Technology, and on Capitol Hill for Senators Wyden and Feingold. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's symbiotic relationship with the Islamic State. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Robert Kuttner, the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity Versus Possibility. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Trump and Mateen, Brothers in Hate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Kuttner.
Happy to be back, as always.
And along with this sort of symbiosis, if you will, that you point out between Trump and the shooter, the massacre, the 49 people at the nightclub in Orlando, the worst terrorist attack in the United States since 9/11, surely there's also a symbiosis in a curious way between Trump and ISIS, the Islamic State, who the Mateen claimed a last-minute adherence to, in the sense that, you know, Trump suddenly goes up in the polls at the minute there's a terrorist attack, and many people think that if there's more terrorist attack closer to the election, that will serve Trump's interests and hurt Hillary Clinton. So is that a fair observation, that there's a kind of peculiar symbiosis there?
Yeah. I mean, to me, the most interesting question is, now that he is pretty clear that he's a full-on fascist, will there be another round of Republican leaders just saying, we have to stop this guy before he destroys democracy in America? And I think as he gets crazier and crazier, we will probably see another round of this. The really shocking thing is that so many Republicans have decided to make their peace with him, either because they're afraid of his voters or because they think he can be used in the same way that a number of German conservatives thought that Hitler could be used. And, you know, you wonder, as his full craziness becomes more and more florid, if that's going to happen. One would like to think that there are limits to how many people will actually vote for this guy, no matter how many ISIS incidents or incidents that can be partly attributed to terrorism there are, because he lives in a, you know, an alternative universe. And I just wish that Hillary were better at this. I mean, Obama has shown that he's really good at this. And Elizabeth Warren is really good at this. Hillary's not bad at it, but she needs to be better than not bad.
Well, it's an extraordinary, in a way, it's a referendum on the American people, what is happening here. The idea that this man, as Sid Blumenthal mentioned, Trump was the dog that caught the fire truck, that he started out running for president as a branding exercise to improve his business brand. And then it seems to have gotten ahead of him, and he's now the nominee for the Republican Party, running for a job that he may not even want.
He clearly wants it. At some point, he realized he could have it, and his ego just got all excited. And but you know, it's also a sign of how thin American democracy is. It's a sign of how American capitalism has stopped delivering for so many people, and the disconnect between people's economic needs and their yearnings and what the political system has been able to deliver. It's also a signal of what happens when mainstream progressivism gets blocked and all of that anger gets captured by the right, and it's a perfect storm, if you will. I mean, it's Hillary Clinton, who's probably not the best person to represent mainstream and sanity and progressive aspirations, combined with a refugee crisis, a set of terrorist attacks, a lot of angry loners who find it expedient to invoke ISIS in justifying their own hatred, which would be simply the act of crazy people or the act of loners if ISIS were not out there to invoke. So it really is a perfect storm. And the question really is whether, as you say, the American people can rise to the occasion, but also whether the Democratic Party leadership can rise to the occasion, and whether the Republican Party has enough leaders who recognize what a total menace this guy is.
Well, it seems that Hillary Clinton, as you mentioned, is perhaps not the best messenger, if you will, for liberal ideas, many of which, and progressive ideas, many of which Bernie Sanders brought to the table. And it would seem that Trump, in many ways, has captured a lot of the angst that's out there. I think that the angst over immigration is a very real thing. We do have a broken immigration system. That is clear. Trump has moved the Republican Party away from its normal attractions to white working class voters, which is usually about guns and abortion. He's added to that outsourcing and bad trade deals, which really resonates. Why do you think Hillary Clinton can't jump on that bandwagon and do an end run around him? Because the problem is that our elites have failed us. They've failed working Americans. Yeah. And
well, she has been around the track so many times that she's very guarded and very formulaic. And I mean, I think under pressure from Sanders, she's become somewhat more progressive. But this isn't just about where you are on the spectrum. This is about whether you're the kind of leader who can rise to the occasion and evoke the best in America. And Obama's just better at that than she is. I mean, his last couple of speeches have been absolutely admirable. And Hillary is who she is. She's better in private than she often is in public. She's obviously highly competent. She's, you know, moderately liberal, getting more liberal. All that's fine. But this is a moment that cries out for a great leader. It cries out for a Lincoln, or it cries out for a Roosevelt. And that may or may not be who she is. Now, given that Trump is so crazy and such a threat to American democracy, simply being Hillary Clinton may be good enough if the electorate comes to its senses. But there will be more of these episodes. And some of them may be freelance crazy people who are freelance haters who may find it convenient to invoke ISIS. And some of them may be actual terrorists. And that doesn't mean that Trump has a clue about what to do about it, as Obama keeps pointing out. And, you know, you get the sense that Hillary is kind of a prisoner of her polls and her flotilla of advisors, and doesn't always trust her own voice, and she's just got to loosen up. She should, learn how to just do this off the cuff, the way Elizabeth Warren does, the way Obama does, the way Bernie does, or she's not going to pull the support that we need her to pull.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Kuttner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity Versus Possibility, and he has an article at the Huffington Post, Trump and Mateen, Brothers in Hate. But in spite of the fact that Trump is an anomaly and a dangerous one, and I think in many ways, it's perhaps because of my own personal bias, the more I see of him, the less there is. I don't know whether the rest of the country is going to go through that kind of rather obvious epiphany. But in our recent history, it would indicate that in many ways, the American people and America itself does not control its own political destiny. Back in 68, Sirhan killed Bobby Kennedy over the sale of jets to Israel. The Ayatollah Khomeini basically killed off Carter and helped elect Reagan. George W. Bush was helped immensely by bin Laden and by the demonization of Saddam Hussein, and so on. So it's as though we get whipsawed by these obscure actors from the Middle East, and here we are vulnerable again to it, to the extent that an even crazy, totally unqualified candidate like Donald Trump, who is by no means a comparison to Richard Nixon or Ronald Reagan, could get elected.
Yeah. You know, there's an expression, events are in the saddle and ride mankind. You have the feeling that we're at the mercy of the vagaries of what might happen. Roger Cohen, writing in the Times a few days ago, the New York Times, compared Mateen to Gavril Princip, if I'm pronouncing that right, the Serbian nationalist who assassinated Archduke Ferdinand,
yeah.
And set off a chain reaction that ended up in World War One. And if events break wrong, for instance, let's say there is some smoking gun in the Hillary emails that turn out to be more serious than we thought, or let's say there's some conflict of interest involving the Clinton Foundation and Hillary's tenure as Secretary of State that's more serious than we thought. And let's say you have an emergency meeting of the Democratic National Committee about whether Hillary ought to step down and give the nomination to somebody else. None of this is likely, but none of this is beyond the realm of possibility. And then you combine that with a more serious terrorist attack that really can be laid to the door of ISIS, and then Trump gets up and makes a speech and says, this administration is the gang that can't shoot straight. They're not keeping us safe. I'll keep us safe. It's not out of the question that he could get elected. So that's what's so worrisome. And we really will see something about the maturity of the American people, the leadership capacity of Democrats, and whether leading Republicans put constitutional democracy ahead of expedience.
But in the broadest sense, it does seem that the fissures in the Republican Party, the fact that all of the leaders are silent, they're dodging the press, Paul Ryan is in an untenable position by not saying anything, and McConnell, of course, is squirming. They're all squirming, and I get the impression that the party eventually will crack up, and it may actually end up to the benefit of the Democrats, that if Trump continues on this trajectory, won't what's left of reasonable Republicans find themselves voting for Hillary Clinton?
Well, game it out. I mean, the problem is that silent or ducking is not good enough. And Ryan ought to get out in front and say, this guy is toxic. I'm not voting for him. You should not vote for him either. He's not good for Republicans. And then what happens? What happens is that Trump loses, and then in 2018, Republicans take back their party, and they probably, if Hillary takes both houses, they probably recapture at least one house, because that usually happens after 2 years into a new presidency. The problem is that even if the Republican Party breaks up, as it were, this time, Trumpism doesn't go away, in the sense that this cauldron of nationalism, racism, resentment of liberal elites, resentment of moneyed elites, that all gets fused into a kind of right-wing populism, that doesn't go away. And there's nothing that Hillary Clinton could do. For that matter, there's nothing that Bernie Sanders could do, given the congressional deadlock, that would dramatically transform the economic plight and the cultural resentment of the people who are the constituency for Trump. I mean, you look at what they're angry at. So white working class guys in the South, but also in the North to some extent, have lost status vis-a-vis women. They've lost status vis-a-vis blacks. They feel they've lost status vis-a-vis immigrants. They've lost a lot of income relative to where they were back in the heyday of the blue-collar middle class. You would need a Roosevelt-scale majority in Congress and somebody with the sheer political nerve of Roosevelt to enact policies that would really change that, and it would take a fair amount of time. So whether or not Trump runs again in 4 years, assuming he loses this time, Trumpism as a kind of unremediated anxiety and resentment is going to continue. And that's the problem, that even if Hillary wins, all of the fallout, the economic fallout of the past 40 years, plus the sense of cultural resentment, that's not fixable in the short run. And so we're, best case is we're going to be into a very chaotic period of American politics.
Well, a year ago, the Republican economist Bruce Bartlett, who served in the Reagan White House, he wrote a piece in Politico saying that he wants Trump to become the nominee of the Republican Party, and this will cause the greatest disaster in the election that the Republicans will have suffered for decades, and therefore purge the Republican Party of the Tea Party that's become the tail that wags the dog of the Republican Party. I take it you don't buy that thesis.
No, I think that's really profoundly wrong, because this right-wing populism and the anxiety that it represents, that's not going away. That's not going away. And if you try to imagine a program that could improve that significantly anytime soon, you can't imagine the legislative politics of getting from here to there. There's a quote by the Italian Marxist Antonio Gramsci that's used much too often, but I think this is one of those moments when it fits perfectly, and the quote is this: the crisis consists precisely in the fact that the old is dying and the new cannot be born. And he went on to say that, you know, in this interregnum, all kinds of morbid symptoms arise. Trump is the ultimate morbid symptom, but that doesn't mean he's going away.
Well, he won't go away, but your point is that until the underlying reasons for his popularity, which
yes.
are the fact that the working class in this country have figured out finally that they've been shafted and that the elite has sold them out and doesn't give a damn about them.
Right.
That is the reality that we are faced with. And just in closing then, Robert Cutney, you don't think Hillary Clinton has got the vision or the courage or the political DNA to step up to the plate and lay this out?
It's a little more complicated than that. She's probably good enough. She's probably good enough. I wish she were better. Barack Obama does it better. Elizabeth Warren does it better. But I am a bit of an optimist. I think the American people are going to come to their senses. I think more Republicans are going to distance themselves from Trump. And she's probably good enough to spare us Donald Trump. But I'm anxious, and I don't know anybody who isn't anxious.
Well, Robert Cutner, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Cheers.
Cheers. And again, I've been speaking with Robert Cutner, who's the co-founder and co-editor of The American Prospect. He was formerly an assistant to the legendary I.F. Stone, a chief investigator for the Senate Banking Committee, and for 20 years wrote a column for Business Week. His latest book is Debtor's Prison, The Politics of Austerity versus Possibility. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, Trump and Mateen, Brothers in Hate. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.